You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
Talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemon. This episode is produced in partnership with West Coast Women in Engineering, Science, and Technology.
This is The Best of the West, inspiring women with real stories, hosted by West Coast Women in Engineering, Science, and Technology.
Hello, and welcome to Best of the West. I'm your host, Danielle, and today we're talking to Halima Alabi. Formerly trained as an engineer, Halima describes herself as an interactive visualization designer. After receiving a degree in acoustical engineering from Purdue University, she went into news, working in newsrooms of PBS, Fox, and CBS stations. Later, she obtained a master's degree in television, film, and new media production, and later, a master's in education in mathematics, science, social studies, and technology education. Phew. From there, she went on to work in console gaming, for Sony and THQ. She has worked on PSP, PS2, PS3, and Wii games. This experience and love of all things entertaining has forever shaped her perspective as a designer and her expectations for interactions with visual analytics. She is currently an instructor for the Art Institute and doing visual learning analytics research at Simon Fraser University. She received a Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council grant for her research and has published a book chapter called A Language and a Space, Visualizing Learning Online, in the Learning Analytics textbook, Developing Effective Educational Experiences Through Learning Analytics. Welcome, Halima.
Hi.
Why don't you start with telling us a bit about what occupies your days?
Well, most of my days are spent doing research, so I'll get up in the morning and read a couple of papers, then have breakfast with my daughter, who's 17, go into the lab, talk to my lab mates, and then I switch gears and I start teaching. So I teach online and face-to-face, generally adults who are changing careers. However, at Simon Fraser University, I teach people who are the quote-unquote traditional learners who are coming straight out of high school. So this is great because it really gives me perspective on my research, which is creating a visual cognition model for how people learn with visualizations of their data. So this is everything from what you see on your Fitbit in terms of your step count and how it makes you feel, how you set goals, and then whether you adhere to those goals or not, to looking at your data from educational activities that you're doing. And if you think, you know, oh, I really need to apply myself to this class, you know, to get that A or to get that B, or if someone else looking at that exact same data is demoralized. So how we augment those visualizations such that it helps people achieve their goals.
Wow, that's really fascinating. How did you end up with these few different jobs all coming together?
Well, I came to research backwards. Most people think, okay, I'm going to go through school and, you know, I'm going to go the theory route or I'm going to do the applied route. And I went the applied route. When I graduated from Purdue, it was at a tumultuous time in U.S. history, and I am American. September 11th had just happened. And
that's a big one.
Yes, it made me rethink my future, because at the time I had planned to go into engineering consulting, which is kind of the normal track. I'm a fifth generation engineer in my family, kind of, you know, doing what's expected. And so I thought, oh my goodness, the world could come to an end, you know, in the snap of a finger, in the blink of an eye. And so I went into television and I thought, you know, this job is really fun. I like the people at this television station. I'm going to give myself a year. And it took off from there. I worked in broadcast news for a year. I ended up, well, at that particular station, I think I stayed a bit longer than that year. I ended up producing a Spanish language television program while I was there. And I thought, okay, well, you know, news production, that's going to be my path. You know, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed interviewing people. I enjoyed meeting people in the community and kind of seeing how it all worked. And again, I was fresh out of college, so it was really exciting for me. So I produced this television program, had my pilot, a few episodes down, put it in there. And in television, kind of the sweeps week is what you're waiting for. So you want to see if people, you know, buy into what you're selling, you know, in the television show. And around that time, I was also applying to graduate school, because I learned how to be a producer by shadowing people on the job rather than formally studying it. So sweeps weeks come through, you know, my application for grad school is in all the time. And I hear the best news ever. My show was canceled. It actually was the best news ever, because my show was canceled because Univision had decided to come in and actually have a channel rather than just a show for Spanish language speaking people in that community. So they could better serve the needs of the community than my little show. And at the same time, I got into grad school. So I moved.
Wow, amazing.
Yes. So the same kind of opportunities happened while I was in grad school. As well, I moved from the Midwest all the way to Southern California. At the time, I was a single mom, so my daughter was three when I moved. Got set up in California. A couple months after I got there and started film school, I'd been there less than 3 months, my house burned down.
Oh my gosh.
We lost everything. And this is one of those backward situations. So lost everything, you know, Red Cross was putting us up. Like, it was that dire. So at the time, I had been writing a film, and I decided to submit it to a film contest. When the house burnt, the only thing left was the foyer area. And in the front of the foyer was the script that I had written. The first 20 pages were completely burnt. The thing was wet. It was gross. This was kind of back in the time where things weren't backed up as well as before they are now. Yeah, exactly. And so I took this film script and I thought, well, I need to get my mind off of completely freaking out being homeless in an area where I know absolutely no one. And so I rewrote the first 20 pages of the script and changed things here, there, submitted it. And it was around this time I was thinking, well, should I go back into television? Because as a single parent, there's no one else bringing in money.
Right.
Right. And, you know, I need to replace everything from, you know, my daughter's toys. Literally, we had the clothes on our backs. And I thought, well, you know, should I stay in school? Should I leave? And I actually had one of my instructors tell me it was probably best that I dropped out, because I didn't have anything to offer other students.
Ooh, ouch.
Yes, because I had owned cameras and equipment and stuff, and I lost it all in the fire. And so during the time I'm considering that, and I'm, you know, just trying to put one foot in front of the other, two things happened. I won that script writing contest.
Amazing.
Which gave me script writing software, money to get a laptop, and money to produce my final film that I did in grad school. So that was an incredible thing. And the other thing that happened was that I had a different professor tell me, you know, I have a friend who would like to go on paternity leave, and I have recommended you as the person who he can trust to be a replacement for him while he goes on paternity leave. said, okay, you know, I really appreciate you saying that, that I'm someone who's trustworthy and who's dependable. I'll do it. And my teacher was rather vague about it. But, okay, well, I'll just, you know, I'll go do this this interview here with this person. He sent me to Sony to go interview to be, at the time, an associate producer with someone who was working on AAA video games. Now, this is significant because my parents were very strict when I was growing up. There were two things not allowed in our house: no video games and no television. And I always laugh and say that's why I became a television producer and a video game producer, is because they weren't allowed. So I ended up working with him. You know, paternity leave went fine, and I ended up staying on because I loved working in games. It was something that I had never envisioned, obviously, because I wasn't allowed to play games, you know, when I was young. And I think what got me into that position, besides the dependability that the professor mentioned, was the idea that we go to school to learn how to learn, not necessarily for that particular career path that we have in mind when we begin.
That is so true.
The average college student changes ideas about the career that they're going to have 7 times. I've already had 7 careers, and I'm not done yet. I'm nowhere near done yet.
Yeah.
Yes. So while I was at Sony, I started mentoring with Diva Girls Film Workshop, which is still in Southern California, and it was amazing.
Awesome.
I started mentoring, teaching film and teaching different media arts kind of on the weekends with high school kids, sometimes some middle school kids. Amazing work.
That sounds super fun.
Coming out. Yes, it was. And that was a way for me to bond with my daughter because she was into it at the time. She was doing animation and such. But also that was my fun time, was volunteering. And that's what got me into teaching. So my positions now, doing research and doing teaching, I believe just kind of brings everything together. I've always loved art. I've always loved science. And I needed the type of a career that would let me combine the two. And again, I never envisioned myself where I am, but I couldn't be happier.
That is amazing. That is just straight up a study in how you make the career you want. I mean, you kind of wander around, we all do, doing things that we think are completely unrelated. And when will I get back to working in my field? And then all of a sudden it all comes together and you're like, yes, this is where I was meant to end up.
Absolutely.
I think that's amazing. Lesson to be learned. If you don't know where you're going, that's okay. Just keep going.
Exactly. Just keep going. Learn how you learn best. Perhaps you're like me, and rather than reading all the papers that you go through, you need to listen to them, right? So I use different technology so that papers are read to me, and I'm learning all the time. So when I'm in the grocery store, I may be writing down ideas, or while I'm driving, I'm listening to papers. There's always something going on. And I think that a big source of my motivation would be interacting with my students every day, because I interact with people who are changing careers. Especially for the last 10 years, I've had a number of people coming from the print industry,
you know,
who are highly skilled, highly creative individuals, but who feel like they have less value because what they train for, the career path that they train for is disappearing.
Yeah.
Right. And I need them to know that those skills are valuable in so many other areas, and that their worth is in, you know, what they have to contribute, and that they always have something to contribute.
Absolutely. I think understanding the concept of transferable skills is a really essential one, which is, for those listening, where you identify skills that you're using in one job or one degree and how they can relate to another one, maybe not obviously. But those kinds of communication or editing or writing skills, those are transferable. It doesn't matter where you're applying them. They're essential for so many jobs. So Halima, do you want to tell me how you ended up in Canada after that whole adventure?
Well, I moved up here following a professor who I met at Games for Health. I was speaking as an industry person, and he was coming from academia. at the end of my speech, I mentioned, you know, considering grad school, considering, you know, going back. And he spoke to me after that. We hit it off nicely. I moved my family up from California to the University of Victoria. And then within about a year, he left and went to Texas.
Oh, geez.
Yes. So here I was, brand new country, you know, not knowing very many people, trying to decide what to do. And I decided it's beautiful, it's safe, so I decided to stay. I switched departments, and around that time, I got sick. I have an autoimmune disease, which is one of the things that I deal with kind of on a daily basis. And I got really sick. I ended up having brain swelling and I was in the hospital and trying to continue in my program. And one of the things that I asked for as support during that time was for a professor to allow me to use a video conference classroom so that I could still participate in my courses. Mm-hmm. And she refused.
Now, need to be accessible.
Right. Now, mind you, this is technology that the university had. This was a room that they used for their actual conferences, you know, and she was already scheduled in that room. All she had to do was say, yes, I had a peer who would push the button for her. Absolutely not. So because of this, because my core courses were face to face and I was too sick to do it, I had to leave my PhD program there.
That is so unfortunate.
It is, because I lost the opportunity to collaborate with some really excellent people just because of this fear of utilizing technology.
And it is really a fear.
It is. And it's a fear, and it's an understandable fear. I mean, as an instructor myself, I absolutely understand that fear. It, you know, teaching in different modalities. So the last professor who I was working with at the University of Victoria, it really didn't sit well with her what happened to me during my time there. And so she started, she has a startup now called AIM, Accessibility, Innovation, and Mobility. Actually, this past weekend, we participated in the Open Innovation Challenge.
Awesome.
Yes, she's got some great backers, including TELUS, to be able to create cyber proxies for students on campus. So not only students with disabilities, but for instance, people with autism, people who maybe you've broken your leg, right? And you can't get across that snowy campus for a semester.
Skiing injuries.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And so you can still participate fully by using these cyber proxies. So they're basically seeing these robots that you can roll into class and you can participate fully. And the thing that I like about this, rather than something like Skype, is all that peer feedback that you get, all those conversations that happen, you know, over the break while people are getting a sip of water, that sense of community you mm-hmm. still have because you have the autonomy to be able to move around, to be able to change the view,
yeah.
right, for how you participate with people and to be able to move, to have that embodied experience of learning. Yeah. So I'm super excited to be a part of this project with her. And it's one of those things where, yes, it was difficult for me, but look what good came out of it.
Totally. That's amazing.
Accessibility is all too important because teams are strengthened by diversity. Just like there are over 1 million people just in British Columbia with disabilities. And you see the percentages in the population are not equivalent to the percentage of people with disabilities in higher education. And one of the ways that we can fix that is by dealing with barriers to entry, like accessibility. The project that I'm working with, the AIM, the Accessibility Innovation Mobility Project, is creating a digital platform. So kind of like PlugShare or Uber, where someone can locate where the class that they want to attend is on a map. And then the telepresence technology exists nearby and is bookable for the amount of time that they need to attend their class, to move around, maybe to go speak to a professor if they need to attend a group study session if they need to, without accessibility being a challenge, right? We want to free up that brain space for innovation.
That's amazing. I mean, I can only imagine the trouble that stairs would give to such a presence here on SFU campus. We have many stairs.
We do have many stairs. And one of the things that's interesting is that the building codes for wheelchair ramps for accessibility were created in 1987. And yet we're still dealing with these accessibility challenges. And that's one of the issues with having a disability that is, quote unquote, invisible. People can see a wheelchair ramp and they think of visible disabilities, but they don't think about everybody else.
Yeah. Oh, that's so true. So true. So how did you end up at Simon Fraser University?
So what brought me to SFU is my supervisor there, Marek Katala, and I adore him. He is an excellent mentor for me. Our research interests fit very well. He understands that learning happens in so many different ways, and he's a great person for me to do my research with because we have those kinds of conversations where he can always push back, right?
That's very nice. It inspires me.
And inspire is one of my favorite words because you're breathing in your, what you're taking in brings life. And for me, that's learning. Learning makes me feel alive. Learning from and with my students gives me life.
That's amazing. What a great fit.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a bit about any other people who were essential supports in you pursuing your career?
I believe it's really important to have a village. And so I have supports of my family. Unfortunately, most of them are international. I'm very fortunate, though, to live in an age where we do have social media. So it's much easier than writing a letter, waiting a month and getting it back, like when I was younger. So I have the support of my family, but I also have the support of my close friends, which is really nice. I'm a single mom. I've been a single mom my entire career. My daughter was actually born during my undergrad, and I always loved the fact that after I had her, I had a professor who let me bring her little pumpkin seat into the lab. And so I was literally sitting at a lab bench, you know, tinkering with my electronics while rocking the baby with my foot. And that was fine with him because he was a parent himself. And he understood that, you know, parents do their best work when they know that their children are taken care of.
So true. Yeah. So Halima, you've told us a lot of amazing things about your career and your education path. What would you say at this point is your proudest accomplishment so far?
My proudest accomplishment is being a mom. Every time I look at my daughter, it gives me joy. I had a decent number of people say, oh, you know, you can't have children and a tech career. You know, you should wait. You should do this. You should do that. You know, you should do what speaks to you. I think my proudest moment was when she got early acceptance into her first choice college.
That's amazing.
It is. I'm so excited. I could gush forever about her. Anyway.
Congratulations to you and to her.
Thank you. Thank you.
So how have you been able to achieve, let's call this heavy air quotes, work-life balance of... I know.
Balance! That's hilarious!
Yeah. So how do you balance being a parent and doing all these wonderful pieces that make up your career?
I think having a sure sense of who I am and what I can do has helped me to quote-unquote balance. And what I mean by that is one of the things that I learned with dealing with disability is the whole spoon method. You know, you have so much energy per day and what you're going to allocate it to. And so dealing with a limited amount of energy, a limited amount of time, a limited amount of money, something that we all do, I think pushes you to distill what it is that's really important in your life. And for me, the first thing is being a parent. And then after that is my legacy. So that if I die today, I'm happy with what I've put out into the world, right? And that gives me satisfaction. That gives me a level of feeling contentment every day, even if that to-do list, you know, went up in a bonfire and, you know, we're eating frozen pizza rather than that, you know, organic handmade salad and, you know, everything else that I had planned that night for dinner. The fact that we're eating dinner together and that we're talking about our day, that's the part that's really important for sure.
Absolutely. I think we've heard from a lot of guests on the podcast that some sort of ideal balance isn't really what they strive for, and that it really is determined by you and your priorities. Some people are happy to work till 8 p.m., go to a networking event after that, and, you know, eat the frozen pizza, and that's our priority right now. And other people with kids, that's the first priority always. And I think that, you know, finding that right balance for you is what's most important.
Absolutely. And I think another thing that helps too is getting rid of perfectionism.
Well, that's an easy one to just, you know, wipe away. But yes, understanding how to let things go and be good enough so that you can move on to the next thing. It's a big, big lesson to learn along the way. One I've had to learn here at West.
I think for me, and in many ways, I'm a stereotypical Generation Xer in that, you know, I am used to controlling my situation. Like when I had my daughter, I grew all her food for her first 2 years so I could control exactly what went into her body, like that kind of perfectionism. And as I've gotten older, I've learned that it's okay to ask people for help. It's okay to delegate, and that in and of itself is something that someone has to learn, mm-hmm. right? And being able to work with groups and being able to ask other people for help, it's okay. And that's something that I think, in a way, millennials have up on those of us who weren't, I don't want to say raised that way, but who didn't learn to conduct their lives in the social sphere in the way that they're, you know, being raised to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you said is really important. Learning how to delegate is something you have to learn. And learning how to collaborate in teams. Those are learned skills. You're not just supposed to, you know, pop out of the womb knowing how to do that. You have to practice those skills and you have to get better at them. I think that's a really essential tool in being successful, especially on engineering teams and in STEM fields where collaboration is essential, especially in tech too. People really downplay those things. They think you need to be that like genius person in the corner who can do everything themselves. But that is not what is valuable to employers. They want people who can work together, who can solve problems quickly, which means not one person doing it. And I think people forget that sometimes.
Right. You can be a genius, but you still need to share that genius.
Yes, absolutely. So what are your tips for dealing with stress?
I am all about self-care. Also goes back to what we were mentioning before in terms of delegating. For instance, yes, we want to eat healthy, but maybe you should offload that shopping spree for $5 and have it delivered. Things like that.
Men.
Yes, exactly. Offload the things that you might not be very good at or that you don't like to do the things you do. Also, make a list of things that are free or low cost, under 20 bucks, that make you happy, right? So you can reference that list when you need to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally second all of that. Very important to have self-care tasks like already thought of, because usually when you need self-care, you're not in the best place to think of what you want to do. So even having my partners come up with a self-care deck. So it's like a deck of cards.
I love it.
You draw one, yes, until it's something that you want to do.
See, I have little pieces of paper that I've, you know, written things on or things that I want to do, places that I want to go, and they're in a little jar. And it was cool because my daughter and I had a travel jar and then it just things we want to do jar. And so for the travel, we'll take road trips to different parts of BC that I've never seen before. It's kind of how we discovered the hot springs, Harrison Hot Springs.
Yeah.
Ooh, that was a good one. So it's just little things like that, that maybe you just need a change of pace, you know, to jumpstart a little inspiration, even if it's just being inspired on how to better take care of yourself.
Absolutely. So thinking way, 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 way back, when you were trying to figure out what to study for undergrad, how did you end up choosing a STEM field?
In high school, I was always technically inclined. Fortunately, I went to a school for science and the arts, so it's kind of perfect. I took every single science course that was offered, but I couldn't get into the math courses. And it was one of those things where, you know, I went to my counselor and she said, well, you know, girls don't really go into those fields, so, you know, we'll put you on a wait list for admission. By the way, never got into a single advanced math course. So my mother, my mother, who's always been my greatest champion, said, that's fine. We'll just enroll you in night school. So I went to college starting my sophomore year, and I just took college math courses.